Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Folding Pocket.
Welcome to another episode of The Rabbit Hole Detectives, a podcast where I, Dr. Kat Jarman, Richard Coles, and Charles Spencer chase the provenance of historical objects, both real and metaphorical. Each episode, we set one another the task of finding out as much as we can about a particular subject to present a comprehensive understanding of the origin stories of stuff. After all, everything has a history. It just depends on how far down the rabbit hole you're prepared to go. And at the end of it all, our disembodied voice pronounces a winner. So hello again, rabbit holers.
Hello, Kat.
Hello, Kat.
Now, I have to just say that I sort of try and think, well, how are we going to start the conversation this time? And we've already, while we were waiting, talked about favourite planes, which I don't have one of, but you two do.
War planes.
World War II.
Sorry.
But
yes.
We could two German ones. I'm good on German ones too. Are you?
Well, I know the odd, obvious ones.
MEBF 109, the Heinkel 111, that stuff.
Yes, and the Stuka and the Messerschmitt.
So I can't even join into this conversation. The other one was whether it would hurt to be eaten by a shark, I think. Mm.
One of my elder son's friends had his leg removed on a beach in Cape Town. And apparently, I mean, he said the most terrifying part of it was not knowing where the shark was. Once he was being attacked on his surfboard, it was when you couldn't see it that it was absolutely chilling. And when you saw the dorsal fin or whatever, it's almost not a relief, but at least you knew what you're dealing with.
It's like a sort of spider in your bedroom, but a million times worse.
Yes.
What did he do?
Well, he technically died and then was brought back to life on the beach by a doctor.
So huge blood loss, I guess.
And shock, I think.
So what happened? He was surfing along, and the next thing he knew,
he was being bumped, knocked off the surfboard, and then actually, he now, with one leg, still surfs. I would never go back in the ocean.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah.
Does he know which kind of shark took his leg?
Well, I don't know, but it is a very big ground for the great white around there. In fact, Robben Island, where Mandela was imprisoned for so long, Robben means seal down there, and that's the sort of food area for great white sharks.
I've got a South African chunk in my bit this week, actually. Just a little bit, but Cape Town.
That's good.
Your old gal.
Yes. Well, I love Cape Town.
Excellent. Well, there we go. So, yes. Where do you go from here?
I love it because it's gore. We've started off as in gore.
Yes.
But with a sort of cheery look at Cape Town in the backdrop.
Yeah, exactly. How else could we start? I think we should just go on then, shouldn't we?
Yes.
To all this sort of cheeriness. And we're going to start with you, Charles. And you've been looking into people I don't really know that much about. I know who they are, but not much more. And that's Laurel and Hardy.
Yes. Well, Laurel and Hardy are acknowledged as one of the great comedy duos of all time. And interestingly, they started off in the silent era. They made 106 films together, actually, between 1921 and 51. But they're one of the very few acts that progressed absolutely smoothly from the silent era to the talkie. And I think that's really down to the fact that their physical humour translated easily and the visual and verbal gags were obviously so brilliant that they could straddle those eras with great success. And somebody said one of the reasons they were so popular is because, in a way, they're children in a grown-up world. And there is a sort of innocence about them, the set-upon people always up against authority figures, whether it's an irate employer or an angry landlord or whatever it was. And this was really to the point during a large part of their early career was set in the Great Depression and Americans needed something to laugh about. And we have two very different people. One of the reasons they think that they made the transition so successfully from the silent era was because you had the Englishman, Stan Laurel, the skinny one, if I can put it that way, and Oliver Hardy, who was from the South in America and was also actually a very good singer. So that could be used very usefully in the talkie era. I'm going to start by looking briefly at Oliver Hardy, the rotund one. Poor man. He was 6'2". He's a large, large chap, and he used to battle weight problems and fluctuated between 300 and 350 pounds, so sort of 135 to 155 kilos. And in fact, he had an early serious career in movies before he met Stan Laurel, and he was known as a heavy, which was a large, scary villain, and that's what he made his career at. And he had been in hundreds of movies by the time that he was paired off with Stan Laurel. He was known by his friends and family as Babe, and it was a nickname that came from a barber when he went to have his hair cut as a young man. The barber teased him for his baby face, and he wasn't christened Oliver Hardy. His real name was Norval Hardy, but his father died when he was very young, and he wanted to remember him forever, so he stuck Oliver in front of his name. And meanwhile, I mentioned, you know, Stan Laurel, an Englishman. In fact, he never took up American citizenship. He was an Englishman till he died. And he was born in Ulverston in Lancashire. And he moved around in northern Britain, Bishop Auckland, Gainford and Glasgow. He had acting in his blood. His father was a theatre manager. His mother was an actress. And he was a boy comedian, like a principal boy, really, in the theatre. And in 1910, he set sail for New York City because he had been recruited by a music hall troupe, very famous one at the time, called Fred Karno's. And he shared his cabin on the way to New York with one Charlie Chaplin. Spent 2 years touring North America with Chaplin as his understudy. And we've touched on Chaplin before, actually, because he was in the piece I did about the workhouse and poverty, his mother being sadly committed to what was known as a mental asylum at the time. Anyway, I suppose with Stan Laurel, he started really as a minor star, but his primary income came in America from writing gags for others until he joined Hal Roach, his manager, in 1926. And he was soon paired off. They first filmed together, Laurel and Hardy, not as a duo, but as two of the actors in a 1921 film called The Lucky Dog. And then their first official film was called The Second Hundred Years in 1927. And a man supervising the film, I suppose like a producer, Leo McCary, and he insisted that they permanently work together as a duo because the chemistry was so fantastic. And you have two very, very different characters that complemented each other. But what they knew was that they had something very, very special. And Laurel, the Englishman, the skinny one, as I might just call him, had a business brain. He was a perfectionist, and he would work on gags and routines with huge care and attention. But Oliver Hardy was more of he had a joie de vivre, and he used to go out partying and turn up as an actor and just nail it every time. He was just a natural. We have this sort of series of quite good things they did, of great films. Among the most famous in the 30s are Pack Up Your Troubles, and also one I think is the best called Sons of the Desert. And actually,
Fezzes.
There are fezzes in
there.
There
were fezzes in there.
That's your subject today.
Sorry, anticipating myself.
They did wear fezzes. And also, since the 60s, after the demise of both men, the Sons of the Desert is the name of their appreciation society. And one I insist you all consider watching. It's a classic short. It's called The Music Box from 1932. It's basically a very funny movie about Laurel and Hardy trying to deliver a piano up lots of stairs. And that won the Oscar in 1932 as the first winner of the Academy Award for Best Short Comedy. And they did lots of short films. It was interesting that at this stage, it was normal to do lots of shorts and then a few feature films. And the shorts finished in 1935. This went out of fashion. And so we have other great films there from the late 30s, Bonnie Scotland, Way Out West, and The Blockheads. And what was the secret, really? It was in the character development. It was in what they called milking, which was getting as many gags out of one situation as you could. You built one on top of the other. And then they had very clear brand recognition. The Cuckoo Song was their sort of signature tune, was played over the beginning of their... There we are, Richard.
Brilliant.
So you know something funny is coming.
Yeah.
and their bowler hats. Somebody said,
"Fezzes, Charles."
Yes, and their fezzes, of course, much underrated. And somebody once wrote that their characters are two supremely brainless, eternally optimistic men, almost brave in their perpetual and impregnable innocence.
That's lovely.
And that sums it up. And also they were devoted to each other, which was very sweet. And they just got on with just never giving up.
Complicated. Stan Laurel was quite a complicated person, I think, wasn't he? And Oliver Hardy's circumstances were not always easy.
I think they were quite complicated. They lived life to the full. Many, many wives each, and not always happy wives. Two of them were pursuing Oliver Hardy to the end of his days for money. And Stan Laurel had four wives, one of whom he remarried, and a common law wife. There was a lot of alcoholism. Oliver Hardy's wife, the second one, suffered from alcoholism, endlessly in and out of sanatoriums. Very, very troubled private lives, both of them. And also financially very tricky, because they were just jobbing actors, really. Even when they were stars, they didn't save a lot and they didn't own their films. So any reruns, the money didn't go to them.
There's a parallel, isn't there, with the actors from the Carry On series in Britain, you know, huge, huge stars. And yet they never made, they were just on wages. They didn't earn a chunk in the way they
That makes sense. Yes, well, sadly makes sense that you could be compromised by the business in such a way. But I mentioned Stan Laurel's perfectionism, and he worked out various things which he insisted on. So one is he always had his hair cut with very short back and sides. And this was done on purpose. It was what he called his fright wig. And it meant that if he took his bowler hat off, he could pull his hair in either shock or amazement. Classic moments in those comedies. And also, he wanted to always be seen as flat-footed, so he never wore heels on his shoes to make that more pronounced. They both always insisted that their faces were filmed flat. There was no use of shadows or angles to make them anything other than clowns. And they used to insist on the white paint and the pancake makeup of a clown appearance to accentuate the comedy without the viewer realizing what was going on. You know, they had the sad-faced Laurel and the sort of derby-hatted Hardy. They were a very good contrast and a complementary force of comedy. And they fell out eventually with Hal Roach, so endless deals that... Hal Roach was a very, very clever producer, kept his two stars on separate contracts, so he had control over them. And in fact, in 1939, he paired off Oliver Hardy with a man called Harry Langdon in a movie called Zenobia. Basically, Harry Langdon pretended to be Stan Laurel during that movie. And they split with Roach and signed with 20th Century Fox. They were also on stage a lot. Their final film was a terrible turkey called Atoll K or Utopia. It was an appalling movie made with French and Italian linguistic problems. The production problems went on and on. Stan Laurel was in bad health. Both men suffered bad health. If it's not too harsh to say, Hardy's obesity and Laurel's smoking and the drinking and the culture they were in meant they were often physically compromised. They went on a stage tour of Europe in 52 and 53, and their only US TV appearance was in This Is Your Life in 1954. And the American audience were stunned because they thought they were dead. They didn't know because they'd been away for so long doing their European stint that they just assumed they had died.
Rather good film, isn't there, recently?
Yes, very good. It's a Steve Coogan movie. Yeah, it's very good.
In it.
Oh, right, your man. And then in 1955... without knowing it, they made their final public appearance on a BBC documentary about the Grand Order of the Water Rats, a British variety organisation. And they end it with a very fond farewell to the public, not knowing that that would be the last time they were on screen. And I mentioned Hardy's weight problems. In 1956, he was told that he was seriously ill and he had to do something about it. And he dropped 150 pounds.
Wow.
Very rapidly. And that probably took the sort of legs off his resistance. And he had a series of strokes. And at the end of 1956, he had a stroke that left him speechless. And he died broke. And Laurel declined to go to the funeral and just said Babe would understand. But in fact, Laurel by this stage was also suffering from ill health. And Laurel vowed never to work again in front of the camera as a tribute to his friend, great, great friend. You know, in a turbulent life, they were each other's closest friends. And he stuck to this, even though he was approached in 1960 by Stanley Kramer to be in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. But he did in 1960. Laurel was given a special Oscar for services to comedy, but he was too ill to accept. And he lived a very quiet life in a modest seaside apartment. And some of the greats would go to see him, comedy greats, Dick Van Dyke, Jerry Lewis, and all these people would go to him. And he lived this quiet life, getting a lot of fan mail. He answered every single fan letter personally. And he died in February 1965. His last words of advice to comedians who followed him was, have a hell of a lot of fun, and also not to take themselves too seriously. But the artistic debt has been paid to them, not just by great comedians like Steve Martin, John Cleese, and Peter Sellers, but by artistic greats, Samuel Beckett, Harold Pinter, and René Magritte. They were seriously influential comedians of a type that very rarely comes along. And my favorite fact is really obscure. We are down a rabbit's hole, rabbit hole's rabbit hole on this one, which is that Stan Laurel was born Arthur Stanley Jefferson. And there are various ideas and theories as to why he changed his name. One of the leading one is that he didn't like having a surname, a family name, with 13 letters in it. The second is, rather similar to that, that he thought if he had a shorter name, he could get more elevation in credits outside cinemas, etc. And the third one, which also has some credibility to it, was that he once saw a drawing of a Roman general, Scipio, wearing a laurel wreath, and he particularly liked the idea.
That's interesting, isn't it? The thing I didn't know, and it made perfect sense when you said it, was that he understudied Chaplin.
Yes.
Because there's something about his walk, his kind of slightly retiring manner that's very Chaplin-esque.
Well, it's interesting. There's a strange dynamic between the two greats. So when Laurel was alive, he talked about his friendship with Charlie Chaplin endlessly. But meanwhile, Charlie Chaplin, when he wrote his very detailed autobiography, doesn't mention Laurel once. And I wonder if there was a sort of jealousy of the man who was meant to be his understudy becoming pretty much, nearly anyway, as great as him.
Interesting, isn't it? You would have thought Charlie Chaplin would know himself to be unassailably the king, but because you don't know that until history judges, do you?
That's so true. But, you know, understudies taking the limelight is a tricky one, isn't it?
Well, indeed so. I can remember once we had a support act when I was in the Commune Arts. We were playing the Albert Hall. We had a support act on. And I heard them at the sound check and I said to Jimmy, oh, they're good, aren't they? And then we listened to them and I said, they're really good, aren't they? And I thought, maybe a bit too good, aren't they? It was Terence Trent D'Arby.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he had his moment in the sun. I don't know if you remember that name, but he was huge for a couple of years in the, what, 80s?
Yeah, 87, something like that, 88, like that. But it was with the support act. You just thought, you can be too good as a support act.
Yeah. You don't really want people to come home and remember that.
Remember the support act.
As opposed to you. I can see that being a problem. I'm going to have to go and watch some of these, I think. I feel like I've missed out.
The piano moving one is a
it's
work of
beautiful.
Genius.
And of course, so many things are derived from that. The Plank, that famous British comedy, has to be a derivative of that, I think.
And that was Hal Roach, wasn't it?
It was Hal Roach, yeah.
Fred Karno as well, these gatherings of people. I kind of wonder, was there something, a peculiar chemistry to those people, or did it just happen to be all the good people in the same place at the same time?
Well, interesting too, that two of the greatest comedians of the 20th century, who would be assumed to be American by many, are both British.
Yeah, you know? There you are.
Now, Richard,
yes.
I know that you're dying to get this because you've already been trying to get it into Charles's segment here, so we're going to have to let
Hang
you go
ambush.
Now.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
his now as well.
Yeah, you should.
No, complete ambush away.
You really should. Yeah. So can you tell us all about the Fez?
Well, yes. Now, the Fez, one of my Steam with me. So I was in Egypt recently, and we had an evening of folklore, which, of course, strikes fear into the heart of any person on holiday. But actually, there was a great band came on, and they were all wearing fezes. And I thought, well, that's interesting, the fez still being worn in Egypt, not knowing that the fez was, in fact, outlawed in Egypt in 1958 by NASA. The fez, a controversial hat, then a controversial hat always. Where does it come from? Well, Fez, of course, is a city in Morocco. And it's thought the name of the hat comes from that city, although it could actually be a word from Turkish anyway. But the reason why Fez became associated with that hat is Fez was where the Cornel tree grew, and it was from the bark and berries of the Cornel that created the crimson dye that gives the Fez its distinctive or most distinctive colour. You can have fezes in all sorts of different colours. What is it? Well, essentially, it's a conical felt hat with a tassel, or sometimes it's a little tump, as it's called, and it's brimless. A friend of mine said to me, this is the most stupid hat ever made. And I said, what's wrong with the fez? And she said, well, it's got no brim, so it's no good in the sunshine. It doesn't get the sun out of your eyes or anything. Why does the fez have no brim?
That's such a good question. I've never thought of it.
No.
Because it's worn by Muslims. And Muslims observing Salah, daily prayers, touch their foreheads to the ground.
Oh,
so you don't want a hat with a peak, particularly, or a brim. So that's one of the reasons why the fez is the fez. When did it come about? It was fascinating, this. Well, it was the Ottomans who basically popularized the fez. One of the greatest Ottoman sultans of all, Mahmud II, had a bit of a to-do. And this was the auspicious incident of 1826. Aren't you glad there was an auspicious incident in 1826? The kind of elite military unit in the Ottoman Empire were the Janissaries. Now, the Janissaries started out as they were recruited from across the empire. They were brought up specifically to be warriors. But over time, as they became more important and more powerful, it became sort of hereditary, immensely powerful and immensely conservative. And in the end, the tail wagged the dog. So the Janissaries decided the elements of a sultan's rule, and if a sultan should displease the Janissaries, they'd dispatch him. Mahmud II took them on and won and defeated them in the auspicious incident of 1826, where Janissary power was finally broken, because he saw that the Ottoman Empire was sclerotic and that it needed to be revived. It needed to have new energy. It needed to modernize for a world in modernity, of course, which was changing hugely. Ottoman Empire, at its greatest extent, was one of the greatest empires the world had ever seen. But great empires are always one of the big challenges, isn't it, is not lapsing into conservatism, maintaining the status quo. So the Janissaries were dispatched, they literally were dispatched, many of them beheaded in the Fort of Blood, the Tower of Blood in Thessaloniki. But anyway, it's called the White Tower now, but it was the Bloody Tower. And what Mahmud II wanted to do, he recruited a new militia, a modern military based on European models, and they needed a new hat. Now, the turban was traditionally the dress of the Turkish or the Ottoman military, but he didn't want turbans because, again, in common with sort of large empires we've been around for a long time, they'd evolved an elaborate set of etiquette and sumptuary considerations about who wore what, and the turban became a symbol, which was actually rather divisive. And Mahmud II wanted a hat that would unite and not divide. So the fez was brought back to Istanbul by Turkish sailors of the Turkish Navy, who I think picked it up possibly in North Africa, some say in Greece. It was simply a red felt cap. Now, that red felt cap, when it started appearing in Ottoman lands, was sometimes adorned with a turban. So you would have the red hat with the turban round it. You can see through headgear changing culture, changing values, changing image of the Ottomans. Anyway, eventually the fez was established. And I think it was in 1827, 50,000 fezes were ordered for the Ottoman armies, and also the officials, and also the bureaucrats, the emerging middle classes, the emerging professional classes. The fez became a sign of what they did. Tunis was the place to get your fez in those days. Manufacturing of fezes in Tunis was absolutely enormous and huge. Wool, felt. Okay, you take it, you shape it usually around a sort of structure made out of straw, and then through the application of heat, the fez is shaped. It's quite an elaborate, bespoke sort of job, and then distributed among those who are entitled to wear it. Different fez shapes attributed to Osman shape. There's a Muhammad Ali shape, all different shapes of fez, depending on which Ottoman ruler they went to. Then the discovery of aniline dyes, synthetic dyes, in Austria-Hungary made a huge impact. So fez production shifted from Tunis, mostly to a little town in what is now the Czech Republic, but was then Bohemia, where because of the synthetic dye, they were able to churn out fezes absolutely galore. And it was said that you could buy a fez that cost less than the price of the wool that went into it. It was made in such quantities until 1908. And of course, you'll remember the dual kingdom annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina. So as a result, Istanbul, outraged by this, burnt all their fezes. There was a fez protest. All those fezes were sort of burnt. So they had to find new places of sourcing their fezes. And so the fez continued as this symbol of a new game in town and symbolizing the common purpose and interests of all those of status in the Ottoman Empire. But then what happens? Well, we hit the 20th century. And after all the business in 1908 with this sort of fez revolt, well, 1922, the Ottoman Empire collapses after the calamity of the First World War. And a new leader emerges to replace the caliphate and the sultan. And that, of course, is Kemal, Mustafa Kemal, Kemal Atatürk, as he later came to be known. And he thought, we need a new hat. Because he began to see the fez no longer as the sort of hat of a new meritocratic Ottoman Empire, but as the sort of representative headgear of the Ancien Régime. So in 1925, he passed a law, or rather the Turkish Republic passed a law, which mandated the abandonment of the fez for the brimmed hat. So they started dressing in Western dress as a sign of modernization, as a sign of Turkey coming together broadly on the terms of a kind of Western democracy. Now, this caused a huge hoo-ha because the fez was also seen as something that was respectably worn by Muslims. And in Anatolia, rather a conservative religious part of Turkey, there was a resistance to the imposition of the hat over the fez, and they insisted on wearing fezes. And this caused a huge hoo-ha. And it became at one point such a hot political issue. The fez law was considered to be one so fundamental to the principles of the Turkish state that it could not be repealed, even if it was deemed to be unconstitutional. It was that important. And there were some imams in Anatolia who demanded that their people should continue wearing their fezes. And they said, well, no, you can't. And eight of them were hanged for wearing the wrong sort of hat. So what happened to the fez? Well, the fez, of course, was not simply an Ottoman item of headgear or a Turkish item of headgear. It was all around the Levant, for example, and different fezes in different sorts of places. They went in and out of favor. In Egypt, as I said, the fez was widely worn.
Were they always red, though? The fez has to be red.
No. Some fezes were black, some were white. They come in different colours, but red principally because of the dye. They're worn, of course, now by lots of the fraternal organisations in the United States. So the Elks, for example, they wear fezes, and there are others. Laurel and Hardy, of course. In most countries now, it's worn by Islamic religious professionals in Egypt, for example, because Nasser, as I said, banned the fez in 1958. Again, as a symbol of something he wanted to modernise. He wanted to show, put a clear distinction between how people looked in pre-revolutionary Egypt and post-revolutionary Egypt. But there was one fez he couldn't get rid of, and that was the ushar. You see it now, and it's a fez that's surrounded by a white cloth. Ah. In a way, it's a recapitulation of that whole thing about the turban wrapped around the fez.
Yes.
So you have the fez where there's a tight white cloth, and you'll see it worn by Islamic scholars.
And presumably only men wear them?
Some women wear fez, but it's principally male dress. Occasionally it is worn by women, but only very, very occasionally. And fezes have been worn by all sorts of people. Did you know the King's African Rifles? They wore fezes. There was also, believe it or not, a Waffen-SS Bosniak unit in the Second World War, made up mostly of Bosnian Muslims, who wore a fez with the Totenkopf, the death's head, on the front. French military units recruiting soldiers from overseas, like the French Foreign Legion, not actually French Foreign Legion, but units like that, they would also wear the fez too. Here's the South African fact, Charles.
Yes.
The last fez maker in Cape Town retired last year, and no one took on his business. He lived in Kensington, in Cape Town, and he made fezes principally for the Malay community there. If you're of Malay origin in Cape Town, you would often wear a fez, but no one to make them anymore because he retired last year and no one took over his Fez business. So that's a bit sad.
That is.
Would you like my favourite fact?
Yes,
please.
My favourite fact, step with me, if you will, to the crowded streets of Cairo, where I was only a little while ago, where it was my very good fortune to visit the shop of Mr. Abdul Nasser Bassett, who is, I think, the last Fez maker in Egypt. He's certainly the longest established Fez maker in Egypt. His shop has been there for 130 years. He makes the ujar, but also he uses this copper moulds in there to get the right shape. The copper moulds have been in use making fezes since the 15th century. They are 600 years old. Him and his son is following his footsteps, make, I think they turn out about 100 fezes a day, but nothing like in the volume that they used to. So if you are in Cairo, I would recommend a visit to Mr. Bassett's shop, and you can there buy a fez, all bespoke, made to your specifications. I love a hat. I don't have the head for a hat.
What's your fave?
Well, the hats I wore for work, so berettas or Canterbury caps, but I look I look like a depraved murderer in a Canterbury cap, and I just look sinister in a beretta. But I do love a fez. And you can get short fezes, not the big conical fezes. But
why did hats go out of fashion? If you look at all those pictures from whether it's a football crowd in the 30s or the streets of London in the 50s, everyone had a hat on and now nobody does.
Yeah, well, actually they do. Baseball cap.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there are some people who still wear hats, but or a beanie. Hard to imagine a hat revolution now, but it really was. There really was a revolution around.
If you wore a Trilby or something in London today, you'd be marked out as an eccentric, wouldn't you?
Well, I suppose perhaps you could. I mean, the pork pie hat has made a bit of a renaissance. In the Victorian Edwardian days, of course, the smoking hat. Do you remember the smoking jacket? Often people would wear a red felt or sort of short hat, but with a tassel, which was a fez. Why that would be, perhaps Turkish cigarettes, perhaps Orientalism, perhaps suggestion of it. I don't know if somewhere in one of the wardrobes in your house you got
also, a fez. I believe smoking jackets were there to absorb the smell of the smoke. You know, you just put it on for that. Maybe the hat was to stop your hair getting smelly.
Smelling of... Yeah. I didn't know that. So the smoking jacket absorbed the smell of
it. Sort of heavy cloth. Yeah.
There we go.
There you go. Fezzes.
Well, Kat, what are you going to entertain us with today?
I don't think I'm going to get any fezzes into mine, unfortunately. Oh, I think no hats, really. Sorry.
And how about a large and slim comedian? Can you get them in?
No, there's a wolf.
Okay, no, that's vaguely amusing.
So this is one that's been suggested by one of our listeners called Keith, and it's going to be about... Sorry.
Why are you laughing at Keith?
No, it's really nice.
It's my middle name.
No, it's a lovely... Is it?
Yeah.
No, it's a great name. Sorry. It's not a great... I got a middle name of Morris. So.
Morris is really bad. But Keith is not good. It rhymes with teeth.
No. Yes, what's your middle name? I don't have one.
No, I mean, Norway has middle names.
They're rationed.
Some, yes, exactly. Only that
actually
one.
Brunhilde, you're not telling us.
That would be nice. I quite like that. If there's sort of something very Scandinavian. No, I don't have one. It's quite common not to have one, actually.
Has your son got a middle name?
No. Neither of my children.
I got three.
You got three middle names.
Two middle names. I got Charles Edward, which is absolutely fine. Morris is more challenging. But I had an American grandfather called Morris.
But there are lots of Morrises, aren't there, in your family?
Only on my mother's side, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, back to the wolf.
So my topic is St. Edmund, who was England's patron saint before the other one came along with his dragon.
Yes.
And I do love this story, especially because it brings me back to the Vikings as well, obviously. So we have to go back in time. We have to go back to the 9th century and to the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of East Anglia. And so this is Eastern England, one of the slightly smaller but quite successful kingdoms. And in about 855, this man called Edmund becomes the king. And he's part of the Wolfing dynasty. So I think they call it Little Wolful, but it means something like that. So they've got this sort of wolf theme to the whole dynasty, which becomes important later on. So he was quite a successful ruler and he was doing his thing quite well until 865, when the great heathen army appears on the shores. And this is my sort of comfort zone, really. And this army, this sort of large Viking force, arrives in England. And they land in East Anglia somewhere. So that's the first day. They sort of wreak havoc, really, over the next 10 years. They start out here.
So early. But I once heard they landed at Hunstanton. Do you know anything about that?
We don't know where they landed, just that it was East Anglia at that point.
I wonder where that story came about from.
Probably locally.
Hunstanton tourist board.
I think that's a sort of, But they arrive here and Edmund actually strikes an agreement with them. So he allows them to overwinter and gives them horses in return for not getting killed, basically. That seems to go fairly well. They stay for the winter and then they go north. They go to York, take over York. They go to Nottingham and they're quite successful. They take over lots of kingdoms. And then they come back in 869 to Thetford and go back to their camp. And then somehow this agreement that they had with Edmund breaks down. So Edmund decides to attack them, which is a really, really bad idea from Edmund. And they fight and the Vikings win. Now, we know from a short record in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, the Vikings win, and then it says, and the king dies. And that's all we hear. But then there's a later source.
Yeah. Over-succinct, isn't it?
Quite straightforward.
Yeah. Can I just interrupt? Because my great-grandfather kept diaries, and I was so excited. They'd been locked up in a bank vault because he was worried about people being interested in them, which is not likely. When I uncovered them, released them from the bank vault, I thought, well, I must look up. What did he write about the Titanic sinking in 1912? And I looked it up and it just went, Titanic sank. Not a long dispatch. Anyway, okay. Back to the king died.
The king died. Now, luckily, we have another record from the 10th century from somebody called Abbo of Fleury, who was a Benedictine monk. Now, he lived in the late 10th century, and we have a record from him when he visited the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's called Dunstan. Now, he had this elaborate story, and I have to sort of tell you. So he apparently was told by Dunstan that he remembers something from a long, long time ago that he heard from a very old man at the court of Athelstan, the king, from this man who in his youth had been Edmund's weapon bearer. So we are now nearly a century, but apparently if you look at the maths, it doesn't actually work. So he had been told what actually happened when the king died. So it was a lot more dramatic than this. The Vikings did win this fight, this battle, and Edmund escaped. And the Vikings then came for him. And they said, actually, we'd like you to be our sort of puppet king and rule under us. But Edmund said, well, I'll do that if you convert to Christianity, because I will not be ruled by pagans. And the Vikings said, no, that's not going to happen. So they tied him up to a tree and used him as target practice. Their archers shot arrows into him. He kept on refusing to give in. And then eventually he was taken off and beheaded. And the story then goes that the head of the king was thrown into the forest, into the bushes. Later on, the locals wanted to come and rescue their king. So they went searching for him. Nobody could find the head until they heard a voice calling out, hick, 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 or here, here, here. Follow the voice, and they came across a very large wolf, and between his paws was the king's head. And they then took the head back with this wolf that was now tame and reunited with the body, and they miraculously fused together, and the head was also incorrupted. So this is what turned him into a saint, essentially. He was buried on the spot and worshipped and soon became a very popular saint. Later on, he was moved to the local town called Beardrixworth, which is the town that later becomes Bury St. Edmund. His cult was hugely popular very, very quickly. One of the really interesting things is that this actually became Viking Scandinavian territory, and he became hugely popular among the Scandinavians as well, even though they'd killed him in the first place. So there's lots of coins dedicated to St. Edmund, and he became hugely popular across the country over time. And he especially became popular among the English kings from 10th century and all the way up to Henry VIII, really. All the kings would come and essentially come and visit his shrine. And this, I think, is why he became known as the patron saint, if there was such a thing. It was partially because he was seen as a symbol of essentially Englishness, because Athelstan, who was one of the first royals to really sort of worship St. Edmund, as it were, he was also really considered the first king of the English. And Edmund called himself on his coins Rex Anglorum, which could be king of the Angles or king of the English. We don't quite know what he meant by that. So that's sort of how he became so hugely popular. And in fact, the cult was spread across Europe as well. Somebody, a later pre-Norman abbot called Abbot Baldwin, wanted to move him across Europe. He couldn't take any of the actual relics, any of the bones, because his body was meant to be whole and complete. So instead, he took a collection of blood-stained clothing to create contact relics that he can then move places like Rome to look at, even to Egypt. Later on, crusaders took pieces of this clothing. He became very popular in Scandinavia, Iceland, Ireland. There's a monastery on a little island in the Oslofjord that I used to play in as a child. That's dedicated to St. Edmund, a medieval monastery. And his relics were moved eventually in the 11th century. He was actually moved by my favourite, Knut the Great, who also worshipped St. Edmund very much. And he built or had commissioned a new abbey in Bury St. Edmund's. And that became the shrine to the saint himself. And one of the things I find most interesting, actually, about Edmund is what happened to his bones. So like most of the saints...
And his teeth. With the
and his teeth. I want his teeth so we can look at the
plaque. What would you give for his tooth?
I'd give a lot for his teeth, actually. Yeah, I think I would really like to find them. Yes. But maybe we can. So in the dissolution of the monasteries, that's, as far as we know, that's where his bones disappeared. So we know that the shrine was there in Bury St. Edmund's up until 1539. But what happened then? We thought he was lost. And somebody's written a book, something called Francis Young, a historian, written a book on St. Edmund, thinks he might know what happened to him. Mm-hmm. And apparently, we've got another record from the 17th century. It's a bit like that one of Abbo, where a man called William Hitchcock, who was a prior, his great-grandfather was apparently one of the monks at Bury St. Edmund's, just at the point of the dissolution.
A monk that was allowed to have children.
Yeah, so they were. So they could, you might know about this, apparently that wasn't unusual. Yeah. So they could leave the monasteries.
Keep them on as a parish priest.
Yeah, and then have children.
Terrible one. At Crowland Abbey, they kept on one of the monks, the parish priest, but they didn't provide any means for the priest to support himself, and the community watched him starve to death.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's not.
Make sure you've sorted out the T's and C's.
Yes, definitely. Okay. But in this story, what apparently happened... That's me trying to just move on from your interruption there. So apparently the monks, at the sort of point of the dissolution, they knew that they had to protect this very important saint's bones. So they apparently put the bones, the coffin, into an iron chest, possibly one of the cloister muniment chests, large iron chests, because they were actually locked down in the monastic site because there was an outbreak of plague, and also they were forbidden to leave the precinct. So according to this record from his great-grandfather, they hid the bones in an iron chest somewhere, but they couldn't leave the environments. Where did it go? So apparently the most likely place is the monks' cemetery, which was just behind the abbey church, because a lot of them were dying of the plague anyway. So the theory is that this chest was actually buried within the monks' cemetery in Bury St. Edmund's.
So in your face, Leicester, with your Richard III under the car park.
Yes.
No one cares about him anymore.
Guess even better, later on, that monk cemetery actually had a tennis court built on top of it. So
really?
King so under the tennis court. Well, tennis court is now removed. And we have actually, I've been working with some of the local groups there to try and see if we can try and look for him.
Under the tennis court?
Under the tennis court in this giant thing.
Stop playing.
Tennis point is now removed, so it's open. So we could potentially do that. So there we go.
Can I tell you a story about him?
Yes, please.
You know the story about how he was discovered by the Vikings? He was fleeing the Vikings and he hid under a bridge in the village of, I think it's pronounced Hoxen. It's spelled H-O-X-N-E. I think it's pronounced Hoxen. Someone will tell me if it's wrong, or maybe there's a way of finding out disembodied voice, I don't know. And he hid under there, but there was a wedding that day, and the bride went over the bridge. She saw his spurs glinting, and that's what gave him away, and she surrendered him to the Vikings, and thus he met his end. And I've been to the bridge. It's still there, actually, or a bridge is there at the site, and I had a spooky moment.
Did you?
A very spooky moment, yeah. And I was with a monk friend, and he said, ah, there are places where the membrane between this world and the next world is very thin. Hoxney.
Extraordinary. Ooh. I love that. That awful moment when, you know, the spurs glinting. Yes.
Would that be a story like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles?
No, it could be from some of the other legends or later sagas. These stories get... Yeah, told and retold. It's interesting, he's known as being quite a vengeful saint as well, and he's quite a sort of...
nasty saint, great.
A bit of a nasty saint, he's quite serious. And do you want to know my favourite fact, which is related to that?
Yeah.
So remember Knut? So Knut moved him and actually spent a hell of a lot of money establishing this abbey in his memory. Now, another legend has it that Knut's father, Swain Forkbeard, was killed by... the ghost of St. Edmund struck him down. So, I don't know. Maybe there was something funny going on.
Well, you see, there are places where the membrane between this one
and
the
you're
being struck down by a ghost.
Yeah.
There's always a problem with that, in it kind of like ghost apology, phantomology, whatever it is, where the ghost is a wraith-like spirit that can pass through walls and stuff, but can also hold a sword or a club.
Yes. And we've got a comment from our disembodied voice.
Yes, so Edmund's glinting spurs were seen in Hoxne. I think that's how it's pronounced. H-O-X-N-E.
Yeah. Thank you.
There we go.
It's, so. It's a spooky old place. Alders.
Yes. Brilliant.
Sparkling. It was a very spooky moment.
Yes.
Brilliant. I like St. Edmund.
I do as well.
I love the name Edmund. In fact, I had an uncle Edmund, and I have a son called Edmund. Such an English, handsome name,
I like
I
it.
Think.
It's a good, solid name.
Yes.
You'd marry an Edmund, wouldn't you? Yes. Well, you wouldn't.
I might. Yes, absolutely.
It's true. Athelstan's son was called Edmund, and there's a possibility that that was named after St. Edmund. We don't know.
Does it mean something? Does it have some Norse meaning, you know?
Well, it's not a Scandinavian name. I'm sure it does have a meaning, but...
An Anglo-Saxon name.
Yeah.
I wonder if it was Hans Stanton. If you got his tooth, if you dug up his tooth from underneath these tennis courts, you can find maybe some Hans Stanton.
Can I say, what Hans Stanton's most famous for is a tennis festival each year. So there would be a theme.
I didn't know
Yes. Or Hunston, as the locals call it.
Hunston, yeah. A tennis festival in Hunston.
Yes. And how bizarre, the tennis court connection in this story.
I have sporting tales of sporting prowess from Hunston, from the Crazy Golf course.
I could see you being
got a hole in one.
That's amazing.
And Crazy Golf. I love Crazy Golf.
I love Crazy Golf,
That's
too.
Good.
Let's do
we
it.
We should do That's rabbit holers, too. Do you like Crazy Golf?
Well, I think we should have a sort of rabbit holers pentathlon. So we've got that.
Yes.
And we've got Voga.
Oh.
Yeah.
One of my topics coming up is the trampoline.
Oh.
So why don't we have a go
yes,
at that?
Yes, that's next.
That you'd be good at it, though.
Trampoline
yes, you'd be
park
really good. And roller derby. I suppose you have to do a roller derby.
Yeah, we do. We'll get you to roller skates.
I can't roller skate. I've never tried.
Well, there we go. That's another
cracking sound of fracturing
I think we need to check
ankles.
If our insurance covers all of this. I'm not sure it does, but try. All right, I think we're going to have to round it up there before we get too excited about our field trips, but we'll do that, definitely. So, disembodied voice, can you please give us this week's winner?
Saints seem lucky, don't they? So, congratulations to Kat. Let's give it to you and to Edmund.
Thank you.
Now, listen here, disembodied voice. While I rejoice in Kat's win and Charles' win in the last one, I'm beginning to wonder quite what the scores on the doors actually
are. You won the one before that.
An unevenness.
You did win the one before that, Richard.
Yeah. It seems so very long ago.
You're doing very well. I don't think you should be complaining, really.
Well, I don't know. Let's have some data, please.
Well, the scores on the doors for the entire run of Rabbit Hole are Kat on 13, Richard on 13, Charles on 14.
Mm.
And for this season alone, season 3, Kat on 5, Charles on 5, Richard on 3.
Now, you see.
Ooh.
Gosh, you do keep an eye on it. I mean, I knew it was very level. And I'm sure it'll even up very soon.
Well, you say that. I have a very, very strong instinct for injustice in all its forms. Just saying.
Yes.
And, we'll see what happens. I'm going to have to up my game, aren't I?
Maybe you're the one that usually says the scores don't matter.
Well, that's just if I'm winning, of course. It doesn't matter then.
Right, now it's coming. It's taken us 41 episodes or something to get to the truth.
Very good barrister, disembodied voice. You've got him to actually say it.
Roll the tapes.
Yeah. Right, well, on that, I think we need to just get cracking. So let's see what our next topics are going to be. Well, actually, funny you say about the trampoline, because that is what you're going to be looking at this week. So I expect all sorts of research.
That's a great topic, actually.
The trampoline. Yes.
I hope so.
And Charles, you're going to be researching Freemasons. And I'm going to have to research this one practically as well, I think, because my topic is lobsters.
How wonderful.
This is Freemason on a trampoline holding a lobster.
Yes.
I love this.
Very good.
Great. Well, we better go and start revising, because that's the end of this week's episode. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening. Please do subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review, because it really helps people find us when they're searching for a new podcast to listen to. And can I say, we love reading the reviews as well. They're fantastic.
It's
really appreciated. And you can send us an email if you like, especially to suggest a topic for us to fall down into. That's rabbitholedetectives@gmail.com. So, in the words from Lewis Carroll's Alice, it wasn't very civil of you to sit down without being invited. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.